This is Drew Mackey, and you're listening to Singing Mountain. Welcome to a special episode of Singing Mountain. It's special not only because it's the first episode of 2019, but also because it's about a subject I've tiptoed around a few times but have yet to dedicate a whole episode to. This one is about video game music and its relationship to pop music. And heads up, I'm gonna talk a lot in this one. The track that intro'd this episode is a pop music song repurposed for a video game. It's the theme to a game called The Race Against Time, released for the Commodore 64, among other systems, in 1988 as part of a promotional effort on behalf of SportAid, a charity event in support of famine relief in Africa. But you may know that track better as the song Games Without Frontiers, that Peter Gabriel song that has backup vocals from Kate Bush. It sounds like this. Full disclosure, until I looked up the lyrics, I thought Kate was saying she's so popular. She's not. She's saying the French version of Games Without Frontiers, which is Jeux Sans Frontières, and pardon my terrible French, and that doesn't matter for this episode especially, but in case you've just heard the song a bunch of times and wondered what she was saying, it's that. I actually went through this weird period where I couldn't get away from this song. Like, I'd hear it at the grocery store, but also I heard it at Home Depot, and I heard it a few days later, like, playing from a car that was passing by, and I was beginning to feel suspicious about why it had suddenly come to play such a major role in my life when I stumbled across this Commodore 64 version and was sort of surprised that this Peter Gabriel song got covered, or demaked or demade or however you want to look at it, and used in a game. And it's all the more strange because it was actually licensed for the game. The interplay between pop music and video games is a pet interest of mine, but I've refrained from going into it much on Singing Mountain just because it's tough to research with any degree of exactitude. And by the way, I'm using the broad definition of pop music here, and should probably be saying popular music, because I'm referring to rock and pop and R&B and hip-hop and everything. Maybe country? Actually, haven't come across a country VGM interaction yet, but I'm sure it exists. It is a giant no-duh that what we hear on the radio would influence what we hear in video games, and I'm sure off the top of our heads, most of us could think of examples of this happening. Sometimes it's blatant, sometimes it's pretty subtle, but it happens a lot. The thing is that a lot of the time that influence is tough to track down, tough to prove, and tough to find in the liner notes. Games Without Frontiers being used in The Race Against Time is an exception, because it was actually properly licensed for use in a video game, but also because it was a clear instance of an existing pop song being reworked into a video game and reinterpreted through that system's sound capabilities. I'm differentiating here from, for example, the radio stations in Grand Theft Auto, where you can hear the actual pop songs non-demaked. If the interplay between pop music and video games is something I enjoy, then pop music being worked into video games after the fact is my drug. especially when you can prove that, yes, this VGM composer really, totally, knowingly worked a song, especially a Western song, into the soundtrack to a video game, allowing you and me to hear a melody we know and love reinterpreted with that chippy, synthy, nostalgic sound we also love. Drew, what is this episode about? That's a good question. So the reason this episode started out with a maybe not amazing sounding cover of a Peter Gabriel song was because I didn't want to start this episode with the Ice Cap Zone theme from Sonic the Hedgehog 3, which I actually used to start the previous episode of Singing Mountain late last year. But that one Sonic the Hedgehog 3 track is more interesting than I let on in that episode, and I actually didn't let on because I actually forgot about the interesting thing until a listener named Ryan Cushney pointed out to me that Ice Cap Zone is very likely another example of this phenomenon. A pop song that retroactively got worked into a video game. Again, probably. In quotation marks. For reference's sake, here one more time is the Ice Cap Zone theme composed by, let's just say, unknown composer. This track debuted in 1994 when Sonic the Hedgehog 3 was released, and there was a point when online speculation compared Ice Cap Zone to the Michael Jackson song Who Is It from the album Dangerous, which came out in 1991. Have a listen. Other fans noted that its chord progression actually more closely mirrored that in Smooth Criminal, also by Michael Jackson, and which came out in 1987. If you subscribe to this podcast, you probably already know that there is a long and debated history of Michael Jackson's alleged involvement with a soundtrack to Sonic the Hedgehog 3. I can't get fully into it here, not only because it would make this episode at least 30 minutes longer, but also because it's been covered pretty thoroughly elsewhere, and I don't need to retread all of those footsteps. Among other sources, I'll recommend a pair of YouTube explainers that I'll link to in the show notes, but also this one 2016 Huffington Post article titled The Michael Jackson Video Game Conspiracy. Also linking to that in the show notes, in case you don't know what I'm talking about. It's a crazy interesting deep dive, but if you want the long and short of it, it's this. Among the long list of people credited with the music in Sonic the Hedgehog 3, five of them worked with Michael Jackson. Brad Buxer, Bobby Brooks, Daryl Ross, Jeff Grace, and Doug Grigsby. According to interviews here and there with these men, the King of Pop did in fact have a hand in crafting the game's soundtrack. Jackson, however, is not credited in the game itself, and his work is not acknowledged by Sega. Per the Huffington Post article, Jackson's music collaborators say that this happened because Jackson didn't like the way his compositions translated through the sound capabilities of the Sega Genesis. But according to a former Sega employee interviewed in the same piece, Jackson's withdrawal from Sonic 3 resulted from the allegations around the time that he'd molested an underage boy. Sega's official stance is that the collaboration never happened, and Jackson's death in 2009 doesn't seem to have motivated the company to change its story. I point out that last bit just because there was a similar mystery about Jackson's alleged involvement in the third season of The Simpsons, in the episode Stark Raving Dad, where Homer goes to a mental hospital. At the time, the show couldn't outright say that Jackson voiced a character in the episode, but shortly after Jackson died, Fox aired the episode again, which was a tacit acknowledgement. Matt Groening actually, finally, solidly confirmed that Jackson participated in the episode only in 2018. Regardless of which of the stories about Sonic the Hedgehog 3 are true, there are quite a few similarities between Michael Jackson songs and music from the game. Listen to the theme from Carnival Night Zone. And then compare it to Jam, which was also on Jackson's Dangerous album. Listen to the end credits theme. And compare it to Stranger in Moscow from Jackson's 1995 album, History. Because to this day, we don't know who composed the individual tracks on Sonic 3, the show notes for episode 55 credit Ice Cap Zone as being by an unknown composer, but listener Ryan pointed out that the song was most likely composed by Brad Buxer, a longtime Michael Jackson collaborator, but also, before that, a member of the early 80s new wave band The Jetsons, that's with a Z because they didn't want to be sued by Hanna-Barbera, which in 1982 put out an album that has a track called Hard Times. Here is that song. Again, Ice Cap Zone. And again, Hard Times. And here is a mashup of the two, posted on YouTube by a user named Alan Mallon. Via Twitter, I asked Mallon if he had to alter the tempo of either song to lay them over each other so perfectly. And he said that he only thinks he had to slow the Sonic track down by a few beats per minute. That's it. Buxer played keyboards for the Jetsons. I can't seem to find who composed the Jetsons song, but even if it wasn't Buxer, it would have been something he would have known and more than likely remembered when he went to work on Sonic 3. None of this is news that I'm breaking. It's been on the internet for a long time, but it still feels weird to me to hear the Jetson song and wonder if I'd consider this too to be an example of a pop song, new wave is a form of pop after all, reconstructed for a video game. The connection between Sega and the Jackson family neither begins nor ends with Sonic 3. I feel like we all have it at the back of our heads that Sega put out the game Michael Jackson's Moonwalker, but have you played it, like, recently? There is an arcade bar here in LA called Button Mash, and it has Moonwalker, and it is insane. It has a ton of Michael's music turned into VGM by composer Toru Nakabayashi, and it's not bad. Here, for example, is the game's take on Billie Jean. But the game is also nuts just because it has players controlling multiple Michaels as you fight through these generic-looking Dick Tracy gangsters, and you rescue children who thank Michael by name, and that seems a little weird, but not as weird as the fact that the game's power-up is Bubbles, Michael's real-life chimpanzee, who, if you touch him, turns you into a metallic cyborg who fires lasers. That was a weird sentence to write, and that is also a weird sentence to read. And then there's Space Channel 5. A music game developed by Sega and first released for the Dreamcast in 1999. The game's hero is Ulala, or Ulala. She's a space reporter who looks like a certain real-life pop star, and yes, that resemblance is something I'll be covering in a future episode of this series. But the game also features Space Michael, a character who looks like and who is voiced by Michael Jackson. Like, officially. It's really weird.
Roger. Everyone, follow me. Left, down, up.
Strike a pose! Left, down, up.
Boom! Ulala, let's go ahead.
Space Michael has a role in the sequel, too, and the fact that this happened after the first spate of molestation allegations, though before the second one a few years later, makes me think less of the notion that Sega minimized Jackson's involvement in Sonic 3 as a result of the scandal. This is pure speculation on my part, but the original allegations ended with Jackson settling with the family of the plaintiff while denying any wrongdoing. Despite the fact that he protested his innocence, his public image really took a hit, and kind of never really recovered, and I feel like if Sega was concerned about bad optics, even in 1999, there would be no Space Michael in the series. Anyway, it's not just Michael. I really wish I could get into LaToya Jackson or Jermaine Jackson here. Did you know that Jermaine named one of his sons Your Majesty? Because he did, and I feel like the world needs to know that. However, I'm going to talk about Janet. You may know Janet Jackson's song Together Again from the 1997 album The Velvet Rope, though if you're like me, you probably think the song is called Everywhere I Go as a result of the chorus that comes in about 1 minute and 45 seconds. was a big enough hit that it would have been hard not to have heard it if you were listening to music in the late 90s, even if you were a strictly alt-rock kid like I was. In doing some research online about Michael and video game music, I ended up listening to music from a different Sonic game. In 1991, about 6 months after Sonic the Hedgehog debuted on the Genesis, Sega put out an 8-bit version on the Game Gear and Master System, also called Sonic the Hedgehog. This is very confusing, by the way. Sega, I wish you had not done that and called it something else. This other Sonic does use reinterpretations of Masato Nakamura's music from the Genesis version, but also features some original tracks by Yuzo Koshiro, who is the genius who did Streets of Rage, but also ActRaiser and a lot of other stuff, to the point that it's weird thinking of him playing Second Banana to anyone, but nonetheless, this is the case. He also did Super Adventure Island for the Super NES, and that game's music is so much better than you might think. Listen to episode 39 to hear what I'm talking about. Anyway, in this other Sonic the Hedgehog game, the second area is called Bridge Zone, and it sounds like this. Again, Janet's together again. And again, Bridge Zone. This is another example of interaction between VGM and pop music, and one you've probably seen on message boards. The one where someone is like, OMG, this song rips off this other song, and sometimes it's the VGM track ripping off the pop tune, and sometimes it's the mainstream work of pop that's allegedly stealing from video games. But one person's OMG total ripoff is another person's, well, okay, not so fast. I learned how to play piano years ago, and I technically learned how to play guitar, but I'm not musically adept enough to spot the difference between an instance of direct musical influence, homage, plagiarism, whatever you want to call it in whatever case you're looking into, and, say, two songs that just employ a common element of music that exists beyond this one similarity. But lucky for me, I have some help in this deep dive into pop music, and his name is David Russell. You may not know David, but please believe me when I tell you that I've never met anyone who knows more about pop music. And in this case, I mean general popular music of all genres, but also he knows true pop better than anyone I've ever met. He also happens to be Sia's manager. Like, Sia with the wig who doesn't show her face and wants to swing from the chandelier. Also, this one time I was having brunch with David and Sia showed up, and it was a very surreal experience. Not important, just a story I like to tell. Because David knows pop music on a constructional level, but also knows Janet Jackson's discography really well, I asked him what he thought. In his educated opinion, he says, no, regardless of what gamers might say online, Janet's chorus is probably similar by accident to the Sonic track. Quote, it's a pretty standard progression of notes, and those first two trickles down the ivories, it changes right after that. The Sonic theme stays in a MIDI 8-bit digital melody while Janet goes into a housey spiritual. But here's why David is cool. He knew off the top of his head that Together Again was written by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, along with Janet herself. And he doesn't think it's likely that they would have been affected by Michael's relationship with Sega. I won't argue with that. Just because Michael loves Sonic, it doesn't mean that Janet ever would have had to interact with it, to say nothing of her songwriting team. While Stranger Things have happened, it could easily be true that no one involved with the creation of the song ever came across this one not-so-very-well-known piece of video game music. But the prospect of a Janet Jackson Sonic the Hedgehog connection made me remember something else. Another time when there'd been a mysterious connection between Janet and VGM. In 1999, Square released Legend of Mana for the PlayStation. It's the first sequel to Secret of Mana that we got in the United States. The game featured an amazing soundtrack by Yoko Shimomura, and one of the highlights for me is the music you hear in Lumina, a town full of street lamps shining down on cobblestones where it's always night and everyone just sleeps all day. Which sounds really dreamy. The music fits the mood perfectly. Here is Moonlight City Lumina, or Moonlight City Broa, if you're going by the Japanese title, composed by the great Yoko Shimomura. That composition should sound familiar if you are a Janet Jackson fan. In 2001, Janet released the album All For You, which features a track called China Love, also written by Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis, and Janet Jackson. Have a listen. That's the same song, right? And by same song, I mean that Janet's song features a loop from the Legend of Mana's song, maybe sped up a little, but also maybe pitched up a little bit too? Maybe? This is where you come in. I think I'm right on this, but maybe I'm not. David also heard the similarity, and because he's the best, before I could even ask, he offered to ask Jimmy Jam himself. Because, of course, he knows Jimmy Jam, because that's how David's life works. As of the time this episode goes up, we haven't heard back from Jimmy Jam, but I will update this when and if we do. This year, I'm planning to cover this area a lot on Singing Mountain, so I prepped over Christmas break by doing a lot of research into covers and interpolations and musical quotation and musical plagiarism and sampling and all the legal issues surrounding these forms of homage or borrowing or whatever you want to call it. I'm still doing a lot of reading, but one of the takeaways from all this is that as a result of the 1991 court case Grand Upright Music Limited versus Warner Brothers Records Incorporated, which pit the rapper Biz Markie against the man who composed the song Alone Again Naturally, because Biz's song Alone Again used a sample from Alone Again Naturally, if you sample something, then you legally need to get the okay to use it, lest you be sued like Biz Markie and lose that suit like Biz Markie. Which is to say that if Janet Jackson's song sampled Yoko Shimomura's composition from Legend of Mana, then they'd have to say so in the liner notes, right? They don't. But it really, really sounds like the same music, right? Well, maybe not. One alternate theory for how this apparent sample ended up in China Love is that it's not a sample. Maybe musicians came in and recreated it in the studio, which would be an interpolation. And that could be. The liner notes also credit Lee Blasky with the string arrangements, along with a bunch of people playing stringed instruments. I had a look at the liner notes for this album, and it's pointed out that four of the tracks owe debts to previously existing compositions. The title track, which samples the Italian disco band Change, Son of a Gun, which contains, quote, resung elements from Carly Simon's You're So Vain, Truth, which contains, quote, resung elements from The Five Stair Steps' Ooh, Child, and finally, Someone to Call My Love, which features, quote, replayed elements from the song Ventura Highway by the band America. I can't imagine how bringing in musicians to replay this section of the Legend of Mana song wouldn't constitute replayed elements like with that America song. For what it's worth, I asked Lee Blasky, the guy credited with the string arrangements. He said he didn't actually remember the track, although he noted that it's also possible that a chunk of the song might have been excerpted from somewhere else. The really weird thing is that Janet sampling Legend of Mana first came to my attention as a result of one of those songs that sample video games listicles that explicitly notes that the liner notes do credit Legend of Mana. The author of this piece, which I will link to in the show notes, puts it in quotes, contains a sample from the Square game Legend of Mana. If you Google that phrase, in quotes, there are other hits, but they seem to be Japanese message boards where people have just copied and pasted the track listing for various Janet Jackson albums. In English, by the way. And the copy and pasted text cites all the samples, like Carly Simon and America, but also Legend of Mana, with the same wonky phrasing, the Square game Legend of Mana. So what the hell is going on here? Well, for one thing, at least on the VGM end of things, you can pay homage to a known work of pop music all you want and even admit that that's what you're doing and apparently not get sued. Case in point, another of my favorite video game composers, David Wise, discussing Bayou Boogie from Donkey Kong Country 2. I actually played this back in episode 48 in the Name This Tune portion of the episode, and I was interviewing my business partner and she was like, oh my god, does Phil Collins know about this? Just for the sake of the arc of this episode, here is Bayou Boogie. And here is Phil Collins in the air tonight. Obviously, they are very close, though not the same, though close on purpose, because when someone on Twitter asked about Bayou Boogie, Wise said, no coincidence, I was trying to get the SNES to sound like the Roland CR78 that Phil Collins used for In the Air Tonight. Again, that might seem like a giant no-duh, because obviously it's an homage and not a sample, but when it comes to when you can say, yes, I did this on purpose, and when you can say, no comment, please don't sue me, I'm still a little bit confused. Legally speaking, if Janet's song sampled Yoko's music, then it should be credited as such. It's not. Is it an homage recreation like what David Wise did? I don't think so, but I'm not an expert. But if no, then I can't think of a good reason why Yoko or at least Square wouldn't be credited, except for maybe that the collision between VGM and pop music is still the Wild West and maybe rules don't apply. That might seem unlikely, but don't forget the weird circumstances around Earthbound, which came out in 1994, after that Biz Markie lawsuit. Nintendo didn't re-release Earthbound for a very long time, and a lot of people guessed that it had something to do with the fact that the game's soundtrack sampled very liberally from the Beach Boys and the Beatles and a ton of other sources. Listen to episode 4 if you want to hear examples of this, but also hear a really weird personal story from me. Earthbound's composers sampled from so many sources that people just guessed that it had become legally problematic in a way that made Nintendo want to hide it from the world. We thought this for a really long time, But then Nintendo surprised us in 2013 and re-released this Beatles sampling legal hot potato oddity, and did so in more territories than it actually got in the original release, with no notation of samples, I should point out. Why? I don't know. But it maybe has something to do with the fact that, as near as I can tell, there hasn't been a whole lot of lawsuits over sampling and appropriation of music to and from video games. In 2004, Namco successfully sued the rapper Lil Flip and also Sony BMG for using sound effects from Pac-Man in the track Game Over. The suit was settled amicably in 2005 for an undisclosed sum. That is an anticlimactic ending, I know, but it's not the end of this research. I want to conclusively find out how and why Janet Jackson came to use a sample that really sounds like it's from Legend of Mana in a pop song. We'll see how that goes, and already I have invented a dozen reasons why someone wouldn't tell some dumb podcaster why he did or didn't make a tip of the hat to something he heard in a video game. This year on Singing Mountain, I will be doing what I did last year. Episodes where I'm playing music that's all themed around a certain idea, but also the Friday episodes where I just give you 30 minutes of VGM without me talking too much. But I'm also going to be doing these episodes about this whole mess, about the many different ways that VGM and pop music meet up. These will likely be shorter episodes in the future, because each one will focus on one of these collisions, whether it be a pop song seemingly paying homage to a piece of video game music, or vice versa, or whether it's VGM outright sampling pop music, or even if it's one of those lame kinda sorta is it a ripoff or a coincidence things that I will see if I can debunk. This series will be about everything, basically. I have a ton of episodes planned out already, and I can't wait to talk about a billion weird subjects that I never thought I would get to mention in a video game music podcast. I will say that I'm open to ideas, and in particular, I'm super open to instances where pop music gets absorbed, perhaps invisibly, into video games, or video game music gets absorbed, perhaps invisibly, into pop music. I'm talking about instances like Ice Cap Zone, where you'd have heard it 100 times before you realized it had roots elsewhere, and where it's not just a sampling but a wholesale recreation of the original melody into a new format. If you have any examples of this that you've been hiding in your back pocket, let me know. I collect these like Pokemon. This is an ongoing research project, and one thing I've learned about working online is that often posting what you have so far will get the attention of other people who might be searching for similar information, and sometimes that can actually get you the answers sent directly. As such, I will be posting a transcript of this episode on singingmountainpod.com, because Google looks for written words, not words spoken in audio files. For these pop music-facing episodes of Singing Mountain, you can find all the words I said here, plus clips and any other relevant media. Though you've just listened to me say it all, but do your thing. As always, you can also listen to all previous episodes of Singing Mountain at singingmountainpod.com, or also anywhere you'd normally find a podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or criticisms about Singing Mountain, the easiest way to reach me is on Twitter, either at Drew G. Mackey, M-A-C-K-I-E, or at Singmopod, S-I-N-G-M-O-P-O-D. You can also follow Singing Mountain on Facebook. Just search Singing Mountain and then click on the one that's not a bakery, and on Instagram at Singing Mountain Pod. Please subscribe, and if you like the show, please give me a rate and review, because those are helpful for reasons you hear on every podcast ever. This episode was written, produced, and edited by me, Drew Mackey. The cover art for this episode and this whole series was designed by Jude Buffum, a pixel artist whose work I really dig. You should check out his stuff at judebuffum.com, J-U-D-E-B-U-F-F-U-M. Singing Mountain is a Table Cakes podcast. Table Cakes is a Los Angeles-based podcast network that features some really cool shows, including two others that I host. Check them all out at tablecakes.com. I have one last track for you, and it's another Michael Jackson hit as interpreted by the game Moonwalker, which, in all honesty, I will probably never mention again on this show. But have you ever wanted to hear a VGM take on Smooth Criminal? Because here you go.